So, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for your practice and for being here. There was something very touching for me to scroll through the tiles just now and look at each of you and see you in all kinds of personal settings at home and doing personal, kind of little, not too personal, but the like drinking a cup of tea, maybe, or adjusting your hair and books behind you and your bookshelves, or all kinds of things. I just felt in doing that, to felt how this practice that we do is touch into these places in our lives in a way that in a way that brings me to use a word about this practice that I don't use lightly, I don't use frequently, I don't believe. And that is, there's something very sacred about what we're doing. Sacred in the degree to which we're touching ourselves deeply, connecting to ourselves, and opening up to some of the deepest, sometimes the most difficult, sometimes the most precious and personal places that a person can go in their lives. And that process, that journey, that inward and into a kind of integration and contact with what is deep inside of us and deep inside this world, and with our heart opening fully, leads to a liberation. It leads to a certain kind of liberation from self preoccupation, self contraction, self limitation, that opens us up into this wider world in a wonderfully compassionate and loving way and deep way. And it's quite a phenomenal journey we take, and it's not an easy one. It's what I think of it as a journey of a lifetime, and that is not something that we're looking at our wristwatch and saying, am I there yet? Or it's just, I want to be finished with this one so that I can get on to the important things in life, or whatever those are. But this is really a journey of a lifetime, because it's a journey of really living our lives in a certain kind of way fully. Not fully in the sense of going after every wonderful adventure that's possible to do, but fully in the sense that from the inside out, there's a freedom and aliveness, a fullness that comes out that the Buddhist tradition calls liberation. So the topic for today is mindfulness of the body. And mindfulness of the body is one of the very important means for this entering into the sacred realm, entering into this fullness and this integration and this liberation of who we are. And that was recognized in the time of the Buddha. And he emphasized repeatedly how important mindfulness of the body is. And in one long kind of set of teachings, he is very, very repetitively says, in all the different ways you can talk about liberation, he says, there is no liberation without mindfulness of the body. And then after the Buddha died, someone came to see Ananda, who was the Buddha's primary attendant, the person who was supposed to have memorized all his teachings, and asked Ananda, "Now that your teacher is dead, who will be your teacher now?" And Ananda replied, "Now that my teacher is dead, my teacher is mindfulness of the body." And this idea that the body is elevated now to such an important position that, certainly in the Indian context, the guru, the teacher, the Buddha, after all, is often held up in a very high esteem and reverence and value. But then to call one's own mindfulness of the body, one's mindfulness of one's own body, as having the same kind of status as the Buddha, is quite a phenomenal thing to say about what the body is capable of, or what mindfulness of the body is capable of. And when I practice Zen, there's the founder of the school of Zen that I studied, Dogen Zenji. He wrote that awakening happens in the body. Many people think of awakening as something that happens in the mind, And in his Zen teaching, it happens through the body. And I don't know if the Buddha would say it exactly that way, but something very close to it, because there's a very deep integrated connection between what the Buddha called mind, citta, and what the Buddha called kaya, body. And the two can't really be separated from each other. And as we kind of go deeper and deeper into the experience of the body, we actually are touching also the depth of our own mind. And it's maybe possible to go into the mind without really being touching into the body. and then it maybe doesn't become so integrated. And I've known people who've done lots of meditation practice, but it was kind of mind-based, a lot of mental activity, focus on the mind and all that. And it's been very valuable in many ways, but I don't see it as being, those people as being as fully integrated in the practice, where all the different aspects of who they are included as part of the practice. And so this kind of dropping into the body, learning how to be mindful of the body is such a precious thing to do. It's not an easy thing, but it is a valuable process to do. Some of us are quite disconnected from our body, sometimes for a very good reason. Sometimes the body can be very have a lot of pain, a lot of challenges to it. Sometimes the body is the repository for a lot of the emotional pain that we've experienced in life. And sometimes the body, because of that, the body is, we kind of get disconnected from it, or we don't really want to, it's just frightening or even too difficult to touch into the body or open to it because of what's being stored in there. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to open this talk with the sacredness of what we're doing, that this is a sacred work that should be done with care and love and sometimes slowly. And some of the deeper work that we do for this integration process is best done very, very slowly and step by step. And that's why I put so much value on just a regular, ongoing, steady meditation practice. It's the slow kind of just work and moving forward and stepping into and in slow ways is phenomenal over time, what that can do in terms of that integration into the deeper connection and relaxing, softening, opening up that and healing that's possible through the body. I want to give you a couple of quotes from the ancient texts of some of the potential of what's possible, but I want to also inspire you that of what's possible. The Buddha, talking about himself, said, "The Buddha immerses the body in the mind and the mind in the body." It's quite a statement. The Buddha immerses the body in the mind and the mind in the body. And when he dwells, having entered upon a blissful perception and a buoyant perception in regard to the body, on that occasion, the body of the Buddha becomes more buoyant, malleable, wieldy, and luminous. So somehow really kind of diving in, the mind goes into the body goes into the mind. In some kind of way, this integration, this connection to them, changes our perception, the way we experience the body and the mind, and they become more buoyant and malleable, wieldy and luminous. And then there was a monk by the time of the Buddha named Kitaka, and he has this lovely little poem that goes something like this, in English at least. Starts with an exclamation. "Hey, hey, my body is light, having been touched by the vast joy and happiness. My body feels like it's floating, like cotton blowing in the wind." So he's like, hey, you know, he's like so delighted or happy or surprised at what's possible to feel in the body, this feeling of lightness and cotton-like softness. I was very surprised when I went, first started going to the anatomy lab. I go to the anatomy lab in Santa Cruz about once a year with people who are training to be Buddhist chaplains. And it's part of their chaplaincy training too, because the chaplains often have to encounter people who are dying and death. And it seems like a very important part of their practice, and they're preparing to serve people in this deep way that chaplains do, to have some contact with death in a kind of reflective way. And so we do this very reverent visit to the anatomy lab, and the woman who leads us is also very reverent and very generous, and just, we all love her by the time we're finished visiting with these wonderful cadavers. And so, you know, she opens up the body so we can see the organs and what's all these things that are inside. And I think the first time she did it, I was so surprised that it's all, how packed in it is in there. It's like no space. It's like all this, you know, organs packed in everywhere, squeezed together. And the reason I was surprised, because my experience of my body, when I meditate, I close my eyes and really tune in and open up to all the, I guess, all the nerve endings that have senses on them, like that I pick up, and I really feel the inside of my body. There's a vast space. There's so much space in there. I can't believe it sometimes. It just like goes out and out beyond the confines of the room and the lands. It just feels huge in there. And then when the anatomist took us and showed us so I assume that I'm not weird. I'm probably packed with organs as well. But the difference is between the physical body and the experienced body. And that is a distinction the Buddha really, in order to understand the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness of the body, you have to understand this distinction between the body that's physical and the body that we experience. And that because we think we experience the physical body, but according to the state of the mind, how we perceive our mood, our emotions, our hormones, all kinds of things that affect the act of perception, the act of how we relate, how we take in the body. And you can see that sometimes in meditation. With this here, and the Buddha talked about the body becoming buoyant, and the monk talked about the body feeling like floating and blowing, and or me saying I feel all the space inside. There's no space inside, and the body's not going to actually turn into cotton and blow away. I've had sometimes meditating wondering if I was floating, and I've opened my eyes to make sure that I wasn't, and no, I wasn't at all. There was no movement. The physical body was firmly rooted and balanced and held in place by gravity on the ground. But with the eyes closed, what begins to change also is how we perceive the body and the concepts we use in order to interpret the experience of the body. And we have a lot of concepts about the body that we carry around for our body and other people's bodies. And often people's relationship to their body can be external with their ideas that they project back on their body. I sometimes have people do an exercise of looking at their hand and then imagining all the things you've thought about your hand over a lifetime. And your hand is, fingers are too short, too long, too stubby, too narrow, too this and that, too many wrinkles, too many, you know, I don't know, it just goes on and on, the kind of things you can, the ways you can judge your hands. And some of them is not necessarily so favorable and doesn't feel good. But then if you close your hands, and then rather than looking at the hands as something out there, an object that you can interpret and have ideas and judgments about, and you feel the hands, the experience of the hand from the inside out, and if you had lucky enough to have the experience of the judgments and the comparisons of this hand with the better hands, the right hands or something, and we see from the inside, the hand might be probably, unless it's in pain or something, the hand is just fine by on its own. It doesn't have a problem being a hand. It doesn't have a problem being stubby or short or long or whatever it is. It's just a hand for the hand. And it just feels kind of, you feel the vibration and the tingling and the sensations of the hand. And there's a whole different way of experiencing the hand from the inside out than you can from the outside in, if the outside is our judgments we have about the hand. And you can apply this to any part of the body, right? And if your hand happens to be a perfect hand, then I'm sure you have some part of your body that is not quite up to what you think is the snuff, quite up to what you think should be the measure. And you can have that through that exercise and see what it feels like, to all the heaviness that could come with body image ideas. And then from the inside out, how there can be a real freedom from the body images, and there can be a radically different experience of self, of the body, from the inside out, if we free ourselves from those concepts. And this also plays out with things like pain. Pain turns out to be a very complex phenomenon, in the sense that there's many component parts that different physiological and psychological, mental activities that come into play produce what, excuse me for a moment. That doesn't help you any. I was muting the wrong thing. Sorry. All these different component parts that come together, and it's a sum total of the intensity of these different parts that produces what we call pain. And so I read once a study where they had selected 10 different of these psychological, physical component parts that have to come together, and they would rate from 1 to 10 or something the intensity of these. And in one way or the other, if the intensity added up to something like 70, then you're in pain. But which of those 10 are activated and how strong they are varies depending on conditions. And so I've had the experience, and I've known other people have had the experience, of sometimes going to the doctor with a pain, and as soon as there's a diagnosis, pain kind of abates. I'm sure it's happened the other way too, but when it does abate, it's partly because we have some fear around the sensations in the body, and the fear is part of those 10 component parts that are adding to that magic number 70 that these researchers came up with, or something like that. And so when the fear abates, the pain goes away. And my son, when he was 8 months old, he was in a car accident and broke his collarbone. And it took a while to realize what had happened. And so, because we were in the hospital first, they said, he's fine. We came home. And during the middle of the night, he started crying terribly. And it was quite awful for his parent, probably terrible for him too. And so first thing in the morning, we went back to the doctor, to the hospital. And the doctor said, oh, it's a broken collarbone. At which point, he stopped crying. All he needed was the diagnosis. I suspect maybe he was tuned into the parents. And somehow he could feel, you know, the fear of the parents maybe. And as soon as that dropped for the parents, it helped the kid. It's hard to know. He couldn't speak, right? 8 months old. But I'm not belittling pain. I think I have so much respect for it. But I want to emphasize that pain itself is not a singular thing. And how we experience pain has something a little bit to do with how we relate to it. And so when we bring mindfulness to pain, we're being asked to not to step away from the tendency maybe to look at it objectively, look at it through the predictions of what's going to come, the fear, but really begin to feel it from the inside out. And sometimes some very different things begin to happen. I sometimes get pretty intense enough migraines that I'll go to bed. And when I do go to bed with these migraines, I usually roll over on my side in kind of a fetal position. That's kind of what this body of mine wants to do. And I like doing this in a sense, kind of, because certainly it gets it's easier just to have everything, all the sensations and everything get, the circumstance get reduced to very simple circumstance, just being in bed. And then I close my eyes and I bring my attention to the place in my head that is most painful. And I try to put and rest my attention in the most painful spot. And if I do that, then the whole thing becomes manageable for me. But if I'm not there right at the heart of the pain, then I'm not sure all the things that are happening for me, but then I get tense, I get reactive, I get impatient, I get all these other things start happening, and the pain comes back and becomes stronger. And so I know this because if I put my attention right in the pain, it's manageable and I can manage it. But sometimes my concentration is not that good. Or say it differently. So after a while, I get a little bit, oh, it's better now. And so then my mind says, well, I can start thinking about something else. And I start wandering off, and then I'm no longer in the pain. And guess what? The pain comes back. So this is, I'm not saying that you should do this. And maybe I'm kind of odd that I do this kind of thing. But what I'm trying to point is to the degree to which what we do with our mind, if it changes how we experience the body. And the body that Buddha was talking about, mindfulness of the body, was not really the physical body, but rather the experienced body, the body as we experience it. And to be able to start seeing there's a distinction between the raw physical body and sometimes the raw physical pain when it's quite intense, versus the body we experience that is really a little bit a product or is somehow comes together interactively with the state of the mind, the activities of the mind, the concepts and ideas the mind is operating under, and the levels of concentration in the mind, all kinds of things that come together and play with it. And then the experience of the body begins to change. One of the things that also then the mind can do as you start entering into the body with attention and awareness, we start noticing where the body has tension, where it's closed, where it's tight, where it's numb. We start noticing the places in the body that are difficult. We start noticing the places in the body that that house our unresolved emotions, some of the betrayals we've had, some of the hurts we've had, some of the violence that's been done to us, some of the fears that are really big and griefs that are unresolved. They still kind of live in the body. And here again, we see that the body is not apart from the mind and from our emotions. And so as we sit down and meditate, if what we want is to become free, really free, then it's also a freedom of the body, an opening of the body. And slowly over time, the places in the body that house these unresolved emotions and feelings begin to show themselves. There's no hurry for this. You don't have to, you know, feel like you're in a rush, and there's no need to go dive into these things in a, you know, all-out way. Sometimes I think it's best in the slow approach to mindfulness, to slow opening, slow connecting, slow developing confidence and trust in the practice, trust in oneself, trust in tapping in, touching into all the different parts of our life that get revealed as we begin centering ourselves, being in our body, is such a, I think it's a really wise way of going. Sometimes this it's like, the slow way is the stable way. Sometimes if we go into deep states or strong emotional states really quickly and strongly, some people really feel that they prioritize intensity. Like if that's the right way, just you go in there and you blast everything. And that can be cathartic and nice, but sometimes it's not as stable as doing it slowly. And so this idea of mindfulness, of learning how to sit and be present for experience and to learn slowly how we react, how we close up, how we reach out, how we have aversion or desire or the hindrances come into play, and all the things that appear, and to learn how to have a steady, upright mindfulness, a kind of non-reactive mindfulness for whatever comes through, is not so we're aloof from experience, but rather so that we can really allow it to begin to be free and open, and not for us to be interfering with it as much as, or interfering with it or adding to it or projecting onto it or closing it down, all these things we can do. And so mindfulness itself is a very simple thing. Just be open and present for something. But to do that, we start meeting ourselves in all the ways that we don't want to do that. We don't want to accept this. We pull back from it. We attack it. We blame someone or something or ourselves, or we try to defend ourselves from it. And slowly, slowly, we can learn just to the capacity of stable attention that just opens to it and allows it. And sometimes that's called, in deep states, very strong qualities of equanimity, that we really can now equanimously open to what's here, connect to what's here, be with what's here. And then things can start freeing and more and more, releasing, letting go, completing that which is incomplete inside. And as the body becomes more integrated, where there's less parts that are shut off or closed down, then the body becomes more expansive, more open, more lighter. And the whole experience of the body begins to change. And as meditation deepens and mindfulness gets stronger, the experience of body changes in a variety of different ways over time. So that it starts being felt very differently than how it felt maybe before you meditated. And it becomes more and more a temple, more and more a sacred place, a place of intelligence, a place of wisdom, a place of peace, a place of joy, a place of equanimity. And it becomes a place because of all these things we're learning through our body. We're also learning a certain kind of healthy independence from depending on the world being in a certain way, people being just the right way for us, that as we develop this wonderful capacity of strong mindfulness of the body, then we're not looking outside of ourselves so that our well-being is dependent on what other people say or do or how they are or what the weather is or all kinds of conditions that might exist. And that doesn't make us aloof. I think it actually makes us much more compassionate, caring, more capable of responding to the world in useful ways than if the body is closed or the body is reactive to what's going on. So one of the simple ways of developing some mindfulness of the body that it can begin this process of self-understanding is mindfulness of posture. And if you just start paying attention to what your posture is doing, even in meditation, you can learn a lot about the attitudes that are operating for you or the reactivity that's operating for you. And sometimes the postures we take accentuate certain emotions and states that we have. I remember once when I was depressed in college, I collapsed as a couch potato on the couch in the living room. And I was so slouching that I think my shoulders were in the fold between the backrest and the butt rest. I don't know what it's called, where you sit. And it was pretty extreme. And then I thought, this is really weird to be so collapsed, so slouching so much. And so I stood up straight, and my depression didn't go away, but it lightened quite a bit, because the posture can have such a big effect on on what we're doing. And so to begin noticing the posture, and is the posture accentuating something that adds more to it than there needs to be? Or in the posture, we can see our relationship. For example, are we leaning forward or are we pulling back? The first time I saw that for myself was when I was doing a a 10-day retreat in Thailand. And we had to walk through the jungle, kind of a not too far, but a good walk from the meditation hall to the place where they serve lunch. And like, if you've ever been to practicing in Thailand, lunch is like the main show of the day. There's no supper and breakfast is really light and lunch is it. Main entertainment, main. And I was young and quite young. So I'd be famished by lunchtime. And I would be pretty mindful. And then I would start walking down this jungle road to the lunch place. And I could feel my posture changed. And not only was I leaning forward physically, but my center of gravity was kind of ahead of my body, I felt. So this is interesting. So I pulled back and balanced myself. But soon enough, I was eager to have that lunch, and my body would lean forward. And I'd come back, and it was a seesaw, you know, who was going to win? So that's maybe a little silly story, but it's not so silly sometimes when all kinds of other kind of emotions and desires and aversions exist. We pull back and close down or curl up or do all kinds of things. And these can be very subtle movements that we do in posture. So mindfulness of posture is one of the ways to practice mindfulness of the body. And some of that comes into play in meditation posture, that sometimes you can feel the subtle shifts in the posture as we meditate. If you're used to the posture, if you're sitting in a balanced posture, you start feeling when we're collapsed or when we're pulling back or closing down or something. And it's not to make any of this stuff wrong, but that's all very useful part of mindfulness practice. So really learning to see and recognize and open up to what's here. One of the things that I've seen is that as I have opened up mindfulness to how my posture is, and really the times when I'm able to really kind of enter into it from the inside out, it's as if inside of the body, there's a desire to release some of the ways the posture is held or tight or collapsed. And I don't have to be the one who changes my posture, but rather I have to allow for that natural movement of release, to come back to center, to being upright or something. This wish that the body has of how it wants to be, that you can kind of tune into if you start feeling the body more and more and allowing for that to show itself and sit up straight or more upright or something. And then to learn in meditation practice we put a lot of emphasis in, at least I do, in teaching in mindfulness of the body. But the primary way of doing that is to stay with the breathing. The breathing is part of the body. The breathing has a lot of lessons in it in itself. And then when the body speaks up, when something is stronger than or more compelling than the experience of the breathing, that's when we open up to that other part of the body and feel that strong thing, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. So we don't have to make a project out of this, but the body will show itself over time. And over the years of practice, different parts of the body will kind of show itself and appear. And slowly there's this integration process, this opening up into and experiencing more and more what's there. And slowly there's learning to be with the parts of the body that are difficult. There's no hurry to do that. And sometimes difficult, painful parts of the body maybe are not the right object of attention. Maybe we have to wait for a while, or we learn how to moderate our attention. So it's not so, like I talked about with the migraines, putting my attention right in the middle. Sometimes it's actually more useful to pull yourself about as far away as you can with awareness and observe physical discomfort or emotional discomfort kind of from a distance, like you're on a mountaintop or a hilltop and you're looking at the pain far away. And that distance creates just the right ability to stay present without it becoming something worse than it is. So learning how to use awareness and adapt awareness according to what the circumstances are. Sometimes I've taught people with strong physical pain or strong emotional pain in the body to imagine that mindfulness is soft cotton balls and just gently tap on the pain and then pull away. Just very gently, just feel it, be with it, and then pull away. You don't just stay there and linger and just suffer more. But just this ability to know that I can do that. I can just tap it. I can just feel it for a moment and then I can pull away. That's okay. And then learning to develop some confidence and some feeling competence in navigating the world of pain, because you've learned you can tap into it and pull back. You can experience it briefly and then pull back. So the mindfulness of the body, another time that in the suttas, they talk about the mindfulness of the body being your friend. And this idea that your body can be a friend for you is one of also, I think, a great outcomes of learning this practice. Rather than being an adversary or a challenge. I know the bodies are very challenging and our suffering we have and pain we have. But it doesn't have to remain that way. And that's part of the value of slowly learning the ability to connect with our body, to open up to it, to be mindful of it, and discover what is this in this body? What wants to be revealed here? And really tune in and learn the art of tuning in and discovering what's here in the body. It's a life skill, which if it becomes a little bit second nature, then you'll carry it with you wherever you go in your life, in daily life, and you'll get this early warning signals. You get all kinds of signals about what's going on that you wouldn't have gotten if you weren't tuned into your body. And some of the first indications I have that something is off, I'm uncomfortable with a social situation, that I need to be more cautious or I need to on something or other, is that there's some kind of sensations in my body that's represents, oh, this is interesting. I get tense, I get butterflies in the belly, or something feels a little bit off in my chest or something. And sometimes it's quite subtle. That I think that, when I was young, I wouldn't have recognized at all. I didn't have the ability or the sensitivity to notice these things. And sometimes it would take me a long time then to recognize how I was feeling. But as my sensitivity to the body has increased, I feel like I pick up things much, much earlier. And therefore, I kind of live much more wisely than I did when I was young. So mindfulness of the body is something to, it's an important part of mindfulness. And the way that we teach mindfulness at IMC is, in many places, is to kind of begin with mindfulness of breathing, and then to begin expanding it outwards to begin awareness of the body itself. And it's often done the way I just said a few minutes ago, where we bring our attention to the body when the sensations of the body are more compelling than the sensations of breathing. And then it's fine then at that point to just let go of breathing and practice mindfulness in the body for a while. Just be with the body, feel it, recognize what's happening, bring your attention to it, and allow the sensing of it, rather than the thinking of it, the sensing of it, sensing that experience, like you would feel the hand from the inside out. Feel the body parts from the inside out as they speak and are loud. And when you feel it had enough, for whatever reason, then you can come back to your breathing. And then maybe sometimes we get stabilized in the breath again, and then we can go back and feel, if it's difficult, go back and feel the difficulties. Or sometimes it just resolves itself and we can go back to the breathing. And slowly over time, what we begin experiencing of the body is that the body is not a solid thing. The experiential, what the body that we can experience, the experienced body, is not a solid thing, but it's a river of sensations. It's a flow of changing and constant movement, activities, sensations that come and go. And to learn to kind of rest in that flow of that river, to have somehow like the awareness be still and quiet in the midst of that flow, is one of the ways, one of the pathways to freedom. So perhaps you'll be practicing some mindfulness of the body. I'll talk a little bit more about it as we go along here. And if you have a practice discussion with some of your teachers, that's one of the topics you can bring up, is your experience of what it's like to practice with your body. It's a very rich thing to do. So I hope that little bit my enthusiasm for this practice of mindfulness of the body passes on to you. May your body become your good friend and your teacher, your Buddha. Thank you.